Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm your host, Joseph Pache. Before Thanksgiving, Surgeon General Dr. Vivek Murthy released a landmark report on the alarming toll of drug and alcohol abuse in our country. Likening it to the Surgeon General's report 50 years ago on the dangers of smoking, Murthy cites some disturbing statistics. 78 people die from opioid overdose each day. Overdoses now kill more people than car accidents. And the number of people with a substance use disorder is greater than the number of people suffering from all cancers combined. To make matters worse, only 10% of people with addiction are treated. And faced with the growing heroin epidemic, Dr. Murthy's report is a call to action to treat and fund addiction disorders like a chronic disease and not a so-called character flaw. This would require changes to how insurers pay for care, how doctors treat their patients, and how we approach the alleviation of pain. And so tonight, in that context, we're fortunate to have with us Dr. Anna Lemke, whose book on this topic was just released this month. It's called Drug Dealer MD, and the subtitle, How Doctors Were Duped, Patients Got Hooked, and Why It's So Hard to Stop, says a lot about the current state of the current opioid prescription epidemic. She is the chief of addiction medicine and assistant professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences at Stanford University School of Medicine. And welcome you to the program, Dr. Anna Lemke.
Thank you for having me.
And of course, we want you, our listeners, to participate in this conversation as we always do. We'll invite you to join us by phone in about 20 minutes. The number to dial to join our conversation is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. You can email or text us now at cityvisions@kalw.org. Post a comment at the KALW website, our Facebook page, or you can even tweet us at cityvisionskalw. Do you know of someone who has become addicted to opioids, or are you addicted yourself? Are you a medical professional who has an experience of working with treatment of chronic pain? We'd like to hear your thoughts. So call in, write us, let us know what you think about these topics. So Dr. Lemke, I wanted to start with the title of this book. It's a shocking one. And as listeners probably know over the years, I'm a physician myself, and I treat chronic pain as part of my practice. So seeing this was quite halting. Tell us how you came up with the title.
Well, the title was something that came to me very early on, and I decided to use it for the book intentionally to be provocative. But I do think it's somewhat misleading in that I don't believe that this opioid epidemic is driven primarily by pill mill doctors, that is to say, willfully nefarious doctors exchanging prescriptions for cash. I think driving this epidemic is well-intentioned, compassionate doctors who got caught up in a system that went awry. As it turns out, when I have run this title by various colleagues of mine, other physicians, I was a little bit nervous about their reaction, but I said to one colleague of mine who's a very dear and kind person and a wonderful physician, I said, well, you know, I'm calling the book Drug Dealer MD, and he paused and he looked at me and said, well, that's me. And I think that's really what at the heart of the message in my book is that many of us in the profession feel like we did become drug dealers on some level, and that's not why we went into the field in the first place.
So before you read something for us, I'm curious, who did you write this book for?
So I wrote this book for educated lay people who wanted to learn more about how we came to this place where the medical profession is harming people instead of helping them. But I'm also very hopeful that medical professionals who are not informed about addiction will read this book, as well as medical students, public policy folks. So anybody interested in the opioid epidemic from either a medical perspective, an anthropologic perspective, or a personal perspective. And it's written really for a general lay audience.
Okay. So actually, to that end, I think there's a nice section. It's actually towards the end of your book, but it actually summarizes quite well all the points you're trying to make and all the layers to this issue that you try to give light to. So I'm going to ask, so it can help us structure our conversation, if you could go ahead and read a section from your book just to give us the lay of this territory, of this terrain.
Sure. From 2000 to 2014, almost 500,000 Americans died from drug overdoses. opioid overdose deaths, including opioid painkillers and heroin, were the biggest driver behind these deaths, reaching record levels in 2014 with a 14% increase in just 1 year. More than 200 million prescriptions for opioid painkillers continue to be written by U.S. doctors every year. Indeed, the prescription drug epidemic is likely to continue for the foreseeable future unless we do more to target the unseen forces driving the epidemic. Even public discussion of these unseen forces verges on political incorrectness. Cultural narratives promote pills as quick fixes for pain. Corporations in cahoots with organized medicine misrepresent medical science to promote pill-taking. Medical disability hinges on patients taking pills and staying sick as a way to secure an income. A new medical bureaucracy is focused on the bottom line, favoring pills, procedures, and patient satisfaction over patients getting well. And disjointed medical care and antiquated privacy laws make it impossible for the right hand to know what the left hand is prescribing. Interwoven through all of this is the complex interpersonal dynamic between doctors and patients, riddled with mutual deception, wishful thinking, wounded pride, and desperate attempts on both sides to pretend that a doctor's only mission is to heal and a patient's only mission to recover from illness. Even when addiction is recognized by doctors and their patients, doctors don't know how to treat it, no infrastructure exists to provide that treatment, and insurance companies won't pay for it.
Wow. That's pretty dark there. So let's unpack this. Let's start not necessarily in the order that you wrote this, that you read this section, but tell us about the convergence of factors that really led to where we are today. And to review, there's the role that pharmaceutical companies played. There's a role you believe that organized medicine, and you can explain what that means, played. Accrediting bodies, payers, especially in the Medicare and Medicaid systems. And then there's, of course, the FDA. You talk about that as well. Why don't we take those in turn? Because I think it's important to understand that this didn't happen sort of overnight or sort of randomly.
Right. So I think maybe a good place to start is my subtitle, How Doctors Were Duped. And the metaphor that I use in my book to describe that is that of a train in which the engine to the train is what I call big medicine. So organized medicine, including the FDA, the Federation of State Medical Boards, the Joint Commission, so all of the watchdog groups as well as professional societies. And the caboose on that train is big pharma, the pharmaceutical industry, especially makers of opioid analgesics. And doctors and other healthcare providers are really kind of passengers on that train along for the ride. So let me unpack that a little bit. The impetus to use opioids more liberally in the treatment of pain really came from inside medicine in the early 1980s. There was recognition among physicians that we as a profession were not doing a good job targeting pain, especially at the end of life. This was also coinciding with the hospice movement imported from Europe. So there was a push from among doctors to do more for people in pain and to prescribe opioids more liberally. So let me just say that the initial idea or motivation to do a better job treating patients with pain was a good one. The problem was that the solution to that was not a good one. That is to use opioids more liberally. Why? Because opioids don't really work long term for pain. We know that now.
But we didn't know that then?
We didn't really know that then, in the sense that the data wasn't there one way or another. What we have now that we didn't have then is de facto data that opioids, when used long-term, have a lot of adverse consequences and probably don't work. Then it was more like we were operating in a vacuum. There really wasn't an evidence base. There were a few small studies, more observational, not placebo-controlled. One published as a letter to the New England Journal in 1980 by Porter and Jick, saying that of 11,000 patients that were hospitalized, only 4 became addicted to opioids. And this was touted again and again by Big Pharma, that less than 1% of patients will get addicted if a doctor is prescribing the opioid for pain. But the larger point of this is that the original paradigm shift to use opioids more liberally within medicine came from doctors themselves. Big Pharma jumped on that and pushed that train along by essentially co-opting what they called the evidence, which was really no evidence at all, and then going around to different organizations within medicine to promote the use of opioids more liberally. So, for example, the Joint Commission, which accredits hospitals, they got together with Big Pharma to get teaching materials, which they then disseminated to doctors to encourage them to prescribe opioids more liberally to overcome their opiophobia. Likewise, the FDA was virtually in bed with the pharmaceutical industry to make it easier to approve new opioids. The Federation of State Medical Boards made it very clear at one point that doctors were not going to be sued if they liberally prescribed opioids. And indeed, at that time in the 1990s, doctors were being sued if they didn't adequately address pain. So there were a lot of forces within medicine collaborating with Big Pharma that essentially put enormous pressure on doctors to use opioids to treat pain. And they were told, individual in the trenches, clinician doctors were told, that this wasn't the will of Big Pharma, this was what the evidence showed, when in fact there really wasn't any evidence.
So you paint the, you know, a lot of people have a lot of negative feelings about the pharmaceutical industry, but you're painting organized medicine and other government and governmental bodies and other nonprofit organizations as willfully kind of going along with pharma with a nefarious intent here? Or what do you mean? I'm trying to understand that.
I think that organizations like the Joint Commission, the Federation of State Medical Boards, even the FDA were really seduced by this notion that we needed to do a better job treating patients with chronic pain. And that is true even today. We do a very poor job in this regard, and we need to do a better job. And opioids became this sort of panacea, the magic solution that was going to, you know, fix this enormous and growing problem. So I think it was sort of like a collective willful thinking, plus a whole lot of marketing on the part of Big Pharma. And then the various watchdog groups were essentially asleep at the wheel. The FDA did not go after pharmaceutical industries when they misbranded opioids as non-addictive. The Joint Commission, without any evidence, even though it is their mandate to have evidence before they create so-called quality measures for hospitals, basically didn't have any evidence and not only took the word of Big Pharma like Purdue Pharma, the makers of OxyContin, but actually got material, teaching materials for free from Purdue Pharma and then sold them to the hospitals who had to buy them in a sense in order to meet the quality measure standards of the Joint Commission. And by the way, if you don't get Joint Commission accreditation, if you're an integrated healthcare system, you're not going to get Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services dollars. I mean, there are huge repercussions for people. So it was sort of a runaway train led initially by good intentions within medicine, which gave the whole mission legitimacy, and then pushed along by this stealthy caboose, which was Big Pharma.
So then you've set the stage for how all the there's a structure or an infrastructure to kind of move in this direction. The tracks were laid, so
that's
to speak.
Right.
Talk about how market forces within medicine, and then also what you describe as a culture shift in our society around perceptions of what pain is or is not, also helped to kind of keep this going.
Yeah, so let me respond to the second part first, which does also get to the part of my subtitle, how patients got hooked. So why did patients get hooked on these prescription drugs? Essentially, prescription opioids are identical to heroin. Prescription sedatives like Xanax are identical to alcohol, and prescription Adderall or stimulants are identical to street methamphetamine. So the reason that patients got addicted is because they were given addictive drugs. But another very important shift was a cultural shift in how we think about pain. In the 1980s, beginning about in the 1980s, pain became its own disorder. So this was really a radical shift from the past. In the past, let's say the 100 plus years prior to 1980, pain was something that was a warning system. It was in response to a trauma, a physical trauma, or in response to a disease. It wasn't something that just happened out of nowhere. So this was a big change. The other big cultural shift around our conception of pain was this idea that any experience of pain creates the substrate for future pain. Now, let me explain what I mean by that. In the past, even within medicine, experiencing pain was considered to be potentially beneficial, salutary, to have health benefits. There was this idea that having pain during surgery boosted cardiovascular function, boosted the immune system. Not only that, there was the spiritual benefits of pain. What doesn't kill you makes you stronger. Beginning around 1980, this completely shifted, and we had this new notion of what's now called centralized pain, which is sort of this idea that if you get some kind of painful injury that doesn't immediately go away, then you are setting yourself up for some kind of future chronic pain syndrome. As a psychiatrist, this is very akin to post-traumatic stress disorder, right? This idea that you can have an acute trauma, and that can then go on to cause future emotional distress. Somehow or another, the experience of pain, whether it's emotional or physical, can cause a psychic wound that can lead to future pain. That also drove opioid prescribing because doctors were very concerned that their patients would experience any kind of pain, since the experience of pain culturally has become essentially anathema, something that we don't want anyone to experience because it may create kind of a future problem for them.
And so at this point, there's that culture shift in the notion of what pain is and the risks of consequences from any pain downstream. So tell us about then how what tools did doctors have to treat pain before there was a push for opioids, and how did this shift in thinking, this potential misbranding of evidence as evidence. How did that all sort of come together to really push the pendulum towards opioids as the solution?
It's fascinating because if you talk to pain doctors who have been in the business for a long time and you ask them, you know, what did you do prior to 1980? They'll tell you, we pushed a multimodal integrated treatment approach. What does that mean? That means, we used medications to some extent, but really what we really recommended for people with chronic pain in particular was psychotherapy, movement therapies, acupuncture, trigger point injections, targeted massage. So in other words, the state of the art, the standard of care prior to 1980s was this integrated multidisciplinary multimodal approach. Then you kind of slap right in there this opioid epidemic, and now the pendulum is swinging full on the other way. And what is the recommended treatment for chronic pain? It's multimodal integrated approach. It's almost like we're going back to what doctors knew back then already, and somehow we forgot in the interim. So what needs to happen now and what is beginning to happen is that patients are now being offered things like psychotherapy, cognitive behavioral therapy, massage, acupuncture, etc.
And why did those things – was it just that opioids just seemed so much better, or was there something else about these other modalities, non-pharmacologic modalities, that just – why did they fall out of favor?
I believe that the main reason they fell out of favor is because we experienced a huge shift in our healthcare delivery system in the last 30 years. Prior to 2000, the vast majority of doctors worked in physician-owned practices, so they essentially worked in private practice for themselves. Over the last 30 years, the majority of physicians moved into working for integrated healthcare systems, so they're basically salaried employees. The majority of doctors today. So once you have doctors working in large integrated healthcare systems, there are other pressures on them in terms of how they have to treat patients. And basically what we have now is a system, a reimbursement system, and a health delivery system that prioritizes prescribing pills, performing procedures, and pleasing patients over whole patient care or patient wellness. So there are enormous pressures on doctors within the medical system, encouraging them to overprescribe. So it wasn't just that I mean, part of it was that they were duped by false evidence promoted by Big Pharma. But it was also that prescribing opioids was a solution for doctors caught in a system where they were having to see upwards of 40-plus patients a day, get them in and out, and make sure that they were satisfied with their care. I really feel that opioids in many ways have become a proxy for the doctor-patient relationship. Because of the incredible churn in healthcare and people having to change their providers every year for a variety of reasons, the lack of continuity in care, the lack of time that we have to spend with patients, really the doctor-patient relationship where a lot of healing occurs has essentially gone by the wayside. So opioids are an amazing proxy for that because you give a patient an opioid, they're in terrible distress, they go home, they take the opioid, and they feel like a warm blanket. In a way, you're holding them at a distance. They come back to you a month or two later because that's as soon as you can see them with your caseload, and they express intense gratitude. And then I, as the physician, feel a sense of competence, feel like I helped this person. So it's kind of a vicious cycle when, in fact, there's not real healing going on. And the patient is actually being harmed by this process.
Say a little bit more about how patient satisfaction really also is driving this, or attempts to really get patient satisfaction, measure patient satisfaction.
Yeah, so using patient satisfaction surveys to evaluate their care, people have done studies of whether or not it really improves healthcare. And what it probably does is improve things like wait time or scheduling. But there really is no evidence that, quote-unquote, satisfied patients are patients that get well or are better cared for. In fact, as I cite in my book, there's an article that shows that high patient satisfaction surveys are actually correlated with more ER visits, more prescription drug use, and increased mortality. So it's not exactly clear what that means. But the point is that although there is a very, very hard sell to use patient satisfaction surveys, there's really no evidence that it improves the quality of care. And unfortunately, many integrated healthcare systems, as well as sort of online Yelp services, this is the world we live in. Everybody evaluates everybody else. And I can tell you from my own experience that when I get a negative patient satisfaction evaluation, I mean, it's very distressing. It's exactly contrary to my image of myself as, you know, a compassionate healer. And doctors will maneuver in many different ways in order to avoid, a bad patient satisfaction rating. And sometimes that has meant continuing to prescribe opioids even when the doctor realizes that the patient may be misusing them.
And are there other consequences for poor satisfaction scores of providers?
Well, I mean, as I point out with this one article, it could be that poor satisfaction scores?
Yeah.
Yes. Oh, I see what you're saying. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, in many institutions, poor satisfaction scores are actually, or satisfaction surveys, how a doctor does, is tied to professional advancement. So if you are getting a lot of poor evaluations, you get called up before a committee in your integrated healthcare system or your hospital or your clinic, and they ask you what's going on. So yes, there are huge professional repercussions, not to mention the shame that doctors experience if they're not getting good scores.
In case you're just joining us, this is City Visions on local public radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at KALW.org. I'm Joseph Pache, and tonight we're discussing the prescription opioid epidemic with Dr. Anna Lemke, author of the book Drug Dealer MD and Chief of Addiction Medicine at Stanford University. We invite you, our listeners, to call in with your questions or comments. What are your thoughts about this epidemic? And do you have a question for Dr. Lemke? The number to dial to join our conversation is 415-841-4134. Again, you can dial us at 415-841-4134. You can email us at cityvisions@kalw.org, post a comment to the KALW website, or tweet us at cityvisionskalw. So far we've talked about how there was a very thin evidence base that was pushed, promoted by the pharmaceutical industry and a group, several different players in organized medicine and regulators who just helped to keep things going, and sort of market forces that coming from a different direction, perhaps, that kind of pressured doctors to kind of find quick fixes to help their patients in pain. Another area that was really interesting to me about in your book is talking about how pain and disability and poverty intersect and how those things also are at play here. Say more about that.
So this is a really hard issue to talk about in a way that people don't find offensive, because obviously, you know, people who are on disability for chronic and severe medical illnesses are people who need our support and our compassion. But what I began observing in my own practice is patients on disability for a medical condition who essentially could not get well lest they lose their disability. So it became sort of a self-perpetuating cycle, and many of these patients had chronic pain conditions, and it wasn't just my experience. In the 1980s, the leading cause of disability, leading causes of disability in this country were heart disease and cancer. Today, the leading causes of disability in this country are mental illness and chronic pain. And the reason that shift occurred is because of changes in disability laws in the 1980s, as well as the fact that for low-income people, disability became a way to secure an income, especially with the elimination of most of our welfare state in the 1990s. And so what's happened is that our disability system has in a sense become, for many individuals, a kind of replacement welfare system or social safety net. But in order for those individuals to secure that funding, they have to adopt the illness role, and then they have to validate that illness role in a complex system. And often the way to validate that illness role is to get a doctor to prescribe medications for you. And many times those medications are addictive ones, whether it's stimulants for attention deficit disorder or opioids for chronic pain problems. We also now have data showing that patients on Medicaid, which, by the way, is very often coupled with disability insurance, federally funded disability insurance, patients on Medicaid are twice as likely to be prescribed opioids and six times as likely to die from an opioid overdose. So to me, there is evidence that these individuals are essentially on disability more or at least in large part in order to pay the bills, and in the process are being physically and psychologically harmed just by their participation in the medical system.
So just some clarification, because that is quite an indictment,
right?
Perhaps of people who are on disability as somehow trying to game a system. First, we haven't said this yet, but I want to get you on the record here. Do you believe chronic pain exists and that people are suffering from it?
I absolutely believe chronic pain exists. I've seen this. There are people, more people than ever in this country, living with severe chronic pain. That's due to a variety of factors, an aging population, a population that's growing old with more significant morbidity and illness than ever before, and also people receiving many more surgeries than ever before. And as soon as we do surgeries and we cut across nerves, we set people up for potential neuropathic pain. So I know chronic pain exists, and it's not that I'm saying that individuals on disability don't have real disease, not at all. What I'm saying is that the confluence of the financial incentives to be on disability in conjunction with the real physical and emotional distress that people experience sets people up to continue to be ill, even when there are opportunities for them to get better, and also puts them at greatly increased risk to be prescribed addictive and potentially harmful drugs.
Because my follow-up question is, for people on disability, does it say more about the individuals, or does it say more about our social contract and how wealth distribution or maldistribution in this country?
Right. I think it says everything about our social contract, or our failure to make an adequate social contract and take care of our most vulnerable individuals. We essentially are expecting medicine to provide the social safety net for poverty, unemployment, etc. And in order for...
Mediated through disability.
Mediated through things like disability. Mm-hmm. Right. So in order for individuals to, qualify for those funds, they have to fit themselves into a medicalized mold. Many of those individuals also really do have chronic illnesses, including chronic pain and chronic mental disorders. But the process whereby they become patients is one that ultimately harms them more than it helps them, or at least I've seen that in many cases. And the data do support that regarding a kind of invalidism that occurs through participation in our disability system.
And we'll get more to that about this, those who are poor are disproportionately affected by this and what it means for solutions moving forward. I just want to take a brief break on a program note as a call out to our listeners. City Visions is proud to be celebrating its 25th anniversary this coming month in December here on KLW. And on Monday, December 12th, we'll be looking back at some of the defining moments in Bay Area history and culture over the last 25 years. And we want you to participate in that process. Which local people, events, and ideas have most influenced you and our region? How has the Bay Area changed in the last quarter century? Send us your ideas for our discussion on Monday, December 12th. You can email them to cityvisions@kalw.org. Again, cityvisions@kalw.org. We look forward to hearing from you, participating in this conversation and this look back at 25 years of City Visions on the air here in San Francisco, the Bay Area, and on KALW. So I want to also reintroduce the program. We have our phone lines are all lit up, so we'll get to those calls in just a moment. This is City Visions on local public radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at kalw.org. I'm Joseph Pache. And tonight we're discussing the book Drug Dealer MD, How Doctors Were Duped, Patients Got Hooked, and Why It's So Hard to Stop with author Dr. Anna Lemke of Stanford University School of Medicine. She's the chief of addiction medicine there. When we get a moment here, we'll open up some phone lines. 415-841-4134 is the number to dial to join our conversation. You can also email us at cityvisions@kalw.org, post a comment at the KLW website, or tweet us at cityvisionskalw. So let's see here. We have a bunch of calls here. Why don't we start with Kevin. Kevin in San Francisco, welcome to the program.
Yeah, hi, thank you. I recall in the 80s, perhaps, or 90s, that doctors were criticized for not prescribing opiates, that they were so afraid of being accused of prescribing too many. I think the Bureau of Narcotics and Dangerous Drugs or something was tied to that. And that I remember reading articles that they should be using these so-called tools. Now, we know 100,000 people a year, more than that, die from all prescription drugs, and I'm a little surprised to hear people are getting all these drugs. In San Francisco, when I had surgery last year, I could only get Tylenol, and I had phlebitis in my leg, and it was so painful I literally couldn't find a comfortable position to sleep in for a month. So that was a time when I wanted my doctor to prescribe opiates, but I was refused. So is there a balance here? I mean, we're not talking about, you know, hillbilly heroin and people seeking OxyContin. I mean, I'm talking about post-surgery true pain here when I really wanted an opiate.
Thanks so much for your call. Go ahead, Anna.
Yeah, so I want to first say that you're absolutely right. In the early 1980s, we probably weren't prescribing opioids in instances when we should have been prescribing them. I think the prime example really is at the end of life. You know, nobody wants to die in pain, and we weren't doing enough to help people, ease that final passage. And I would also agree with you that in some instances right now, there's been this kind of knee-jerk reaction to not prescribe opioids even when they're indicated. For example, if somebody has an acute phlebitis, as in your case, or an acute trauma, or has just had a major surgery. So, you know, unfortunately, you know, medicine, including physicians, is full of kind of black and white thinking and extremes. And you're absolutely right. We need to find that happy medium. I think the central message is that opioids are a fantastic treatment for pain short term. What we don't want to do, however, is prescribe opioids long term.
And what do you mean by short term?
Short term is probably on the order of Well, the CDC says no more than 3 days. I would probably temper that a little bit and say no more than probably 2 to 3 weeks, depending upon how major the injury or how major the surgery. You know, certainly I can see instances when maybe even 1 to 3 months makes sense. The problem is once you get beyond about 1 to 3 months of taking opioids daily, there's a process in the brain called neuroadaptation, whereby your brain essentially adapts to the presence of the opioids, and they just don't work anymore. And once that happens, and patients continue to use opioids, they're not really treating the underlying pain. They're essentially treating the withdrawal from their last dose. So that's what we want to avoid. It's not that opioids are intrinsically bad. In fact, they're not. They work great for pain. But we don't want people to develop tolerance. We don't want people to take them long-term. And the reason we don't want them to take them long-term is because they really don't work long-term, and they lead to all kinds of adverse health consequences.
So I'm curious if Kevin's experience there is saying something about how the pendulum has already swung in the opposite direction, and doctors or health systems are becoming very stingy with opioids suddenly. Tell us about how you understand the dynamic on a patient-provider level, patient-doctor level, when concerns, red flags are raised about that things are not going well with an opioid plan, and how doctors might react.
Well, as I talk about in my book, this whole opioid epidemic has essentially been a huge narcissistic injury for physicians. They've been sort of unmasked as drug dealers, and in response, you know, the typical response to any narcissistic injury is narcissistic rage and retaliation. And unfortunately, a lot of doctors are retaliating against patients themselves. So what's happened is that not only do they retaliate negatively and withhold reasonable opioid treatment from some patients who maybe have been misusing opioids but are no longer misusing them, but now they have kind of a blanket approach where they won't prescribe opioids at all. I have a number of patients who essentially end up in my clinic because their doctor, who used to prescribe for them at very, very high doses for decades, suddenly said, "I don't treat pain anymore." And there's even a term that we've come up with in the system called opioid refugees to describe this cohort of patients who used to get plentiful prescriptions, and it was all sanctioned and kind of approved, and now they can't find anyone to prescribe for them.
Or their provider retired, perhaps.
Yes.
Suddenly. Okay, let's go next to Michael in San Francisco. Michael, welcome to the program.
Hi, this is Michael. Thanks a lot. This is a really important subject that you're addressing tonight, and I appreciate it. Am I on? Can you hear me?
Yep, we can. Go ahead.
Okay, cool.
Yeah.
Cool. The last caller brought up some of the things that I was interested in. What are you going to do for patients who need to have painkillers of one sort or another? I have nerve damage to my pudendal nerve, and it's extremely painful. And I started out on, for a while it was only over-the-counter kind of stuff. And finally, I just couldn't believe it that there wasn't something out there that was going to help me. And I was put on to, oxycodone, which I'm still taking. And many times in the period that I have been taking them, I've tried to cut back, get off, give me something else, because I don't want to establish, you know, an addiction kind of thing. But nothing else works. If I don't have it, I literally can't sit still. I just can't stop moving. It is so painful. And that is one thing. And quickly, another thing is I don't see Big Pharma, although they're guilty of many of the things you say, I don't see that pain medication is something that they're pushing at all. There's not a lot of money in it. They're not expensive. There's no research in it because they already have what they need. But I want to know what you're going to do to people who need to have pain relief and do exercises, which I've done. I've had massage. I've had all kinds of different things who need the pain relief. And what's going on, the atmosphere, is sort of like a holy crusade to get everybody off of opiates. And it hurts people who really need them.
Thank you so much for your call. So that's a really complex issue here, right? I mean, we're talking about medicines that have made the difference for a lot of people for a very long time. And we didn't ask the caller that specifically, but it sounds like he's not had any adverse effects from it. So why take something away that's been working?
Well, I would say to Michael that I wouldn't take it away. I'm not some kind of dogmatic, like get everybody off of opioids. I'm really talking about people who have experienced clear adverse consequences, including addiction, near overdoses, or even tolerance and dependence where it's not working anymore. But if you've got an individual who has clearly established at a reasonable dose, so not some of these outrageous doses that we used to get into or still do in some cases, but clearly established that they benefit from it, that they don't misuse it, they don't run out early, there's no other aberrant behavior suggestive of misuse or addiction, and they're not developing other side effects and they're not at risk for overdose, I would say to continue the medication for that individual until which time some other alternative has been, you know, discovered. I think, you know, Michael, it's great that you tried to get off and tried other things just because the side effect profile of oxycodone is pretty intense. But if nothing...
Say some about that.
Well, I mean, you know, everything from constipation to cognitive memory problems, even to depression, hormonal imbalance, it can lower testosterone, increases the risk for heart attacks and cardiac arrhythmias. It can cause sleep apnea, even, you know, while people, you know, aren't clearly having obstructive sleep apnea symptoms like snoring. Just it causes kind of a generalized hypoxia where there's less oxygen in the blood because the respiratory drive is suppressed. So these are all reasons, especially as we enter our latter decades, to really be, you know, very cautious with this medication. On the other hand, if you have a chronic pain condition that hasn't responded to anything else and you don't demonstrate any of these adverse consequences, or the benefits continue to outweigh the adverse consequences, and your dose isn't astronomically high?
Well, that is an interesting question. What is astronomically high to you, and what is the evidence to tell us what that is? We didn't mention this, but the CDC in the last 6 months issued safe prescribing guidelines, and they set 50 milligrams of morphine equivalents, which for those of you lay people out there, considering the doses that are prescribed in this so-called opiate epidemic, that's a really tiny dose compared to what's being prescribed out there. But how did they arrive at that data point, that threshold? Is there are we operating in more evidence space now in this reaction to the epidemic?
I think,
or there's still a lot of unknowns here.
Right, there's still a lot of unknowns. I think the CDC response of 50 morphine milligram equivalents is extreme and not actually supported by the data. What the data do show is that once you get above about 120 morphine milligram equivalents daily, then you are at increased risk not only for accidental overdose but also addiction. So what they've shown is both dose and duration predict increased risk of developing an addiction to opioids and developing making you very vulnerable for accidental overdose. And I just want to say that term, even overdose, is kind of a misnomer because it implies that the patient takes more than prescribed, when in fact a lot of the opioid-related deaths are among people who are not addicted and who are taking them exactly as prescribed. But what happens is that over time the body develops tolerance to the pain-relieving effects of the opioid but not to the respiratory suppressant effects of the opioid. So when you go up on a dose to try to target pain, you know, that's maybe helpful for the pain, but it's really bad for this hypoxemia or you know, a suppressed breathing phenomenon.
Okay. Again, putting the number out for you listeners who want to join our conversation here tonight on City Visions, Local Public Radio 91.7, KLW San Francisco, and on the web at klw.org. We're here with Dr. Anna Lemke, author of the book Drug Dealer MD, to talk about the prescription opioid epidemic. 415-841-4134. We have a couple of phone lines open. 415-841-4134, number to dial to join our conversation. You can also email us at cityvisions@klw.org. Post a comment at the KLW website or tweet us at CVisionsKALW. Let's go to Lindsay from Berkeley. Lindsay, welcome to the program.
Hi. So I'm a medical sociologist at UC Berkeley, and I actually study how medical adjudicators make decisions about whether people with chronic pain are actually disabled or not. So I find this really, really interesting. So thanks. pertaining to disability, you've definitely identified correctly that the issue is about social service provision and not about doctors. But what I see is kind of what you said, that doctors are in fact pushing off the problem to this administrative branch because, you know, quote, it's like not a problem of the healthcare system. But the thing is that how do you deal with the fact that the SSA will only use, you know, what's called medically accepted objective markers of pain? And so that's the tendency to want to use opioids as a proxy because the SSA doesn't consider anything but basically MRIs and such as indicators of pain. And by the way, they don't actually really use drug administration as a good proxy. And also, like, medical adjudicators don't take physical therapy and acupuncture and all these kind of integrated systems that you're talking about seriously. And they also don't employ the kind of complex neurobiological explanations of pain into their account of what chronic pain is. So how can pain medicine, like you're involved in, take seriously that you are actually kind of wrapped up with the state as an institution and the healthcare system is not actually isolated?
Yeah.
Thanks so much for your call.
Thank you, Lindsay. That's a great comment and observation. And I just want to basically say that I think the answer to your question is that we need to completely restructure the way that we educate physicians to make them recognize that they are not working in a vacuum, just curing isolated diseases of one sort or another, that basically physicians and medicine has become the social safety net, whether we like it or not. Now, we can change our system and create an actual social safety net outside of medicine. We could do that. But right now, we don't have one. So what has happened is that doctors are in the position of providing the social safety net to the most vulnerable among us. And they need to recognize that they have that role. They need to be educated on how to navigate these complex systems, including disability. And there's absolutely no training in that, none at all. You know, how do I do a disability evaluation? How do I, you know, figure out if workers' comp? How do I even justify or figure out whether this person should not go to work for like a medical leave? We don't get any training in that. And unfortunately, what has happened is that the easiest way to kind of validate the illness role and justify a patient getting disability is to put them on a medication, as you point out, so that prescribing, you know, potentially dangerous drugs to poor patients has become a new way of helping.
Let's go next to Joe in San Jose. Joe, welcome to the program.
Yes, hi. I just wanted to relate my own personal experience. I have members of my family, extended family, that have horrible problems with opiate addiction due to, you know, having cancer therapy and chronic pain. And I agree with the doctor that they're really not good for any long-term use. In my own experience, I don't particularly think they're that effective for pain. They're effective for making pain tolerable, if you know what I mean. But they don't really seem to affect the pain unless you take a larger and larger amount. And after just a short couple of days, you get that effect of needing to have more to get that buffer to the discomfort you're having. And yet the respiratory suppressive and other effects continue. And I found that you just have to stop. You have to stop every few days. And I don't know why physicians don't ever recommend that you should not take them for more than, say, 2 or 3 days in a week, and then you have to not take them for a few days. And that's what it takes to clear it out of your system, and then you can go back to your minimal dose. I just don't think they're effective in ever-increasing doses. That's the kiss of death. Doctors should never prescribe more and more of an opiate medication to a patient. I don't know why that ever happened even once.
Thank you so much, Joe, for your call. So I think we spent a big part of the first part of our conversation outlining why doctors got there, how doctors got there, what's keeping them from getting out of this problem, or are they already getting out of the problem?
Right. So, I mean, so just, you know, Joe, to kind of go back to your question, why do doctors keep prescribing ever larger and larger doses? Again, I think that's part of how doctors were duped. You know, there were three myths that were propagated in the 1980s and 1990s and sold to doctors as evidence-based, even though they were not. The first myth was that opioids are very effective for chronic pain. The second myth was that opioids are not addictive as long as they're prescribed by a doctor for a medical condition. And the third myth, which really speaks to your comment, was that no dose is too high. So if you have a patient who comes in and opioids work before and they stop working, just go up. And that's exactly how we got to the place where we are today, where you have patients on these really extreme high doses and who are really struggling to get off. And as you have self-observed with your own experience with opioids, it's really hard to get off because of this process of neuroadaptation, where your pain set point is fundamentally altered by exposure to opioids. And in fact, taking drug holidays is a really good strategy for any potentially addictive prescription drug, or to use it sparingly, no more than, let's say, 3 times a week, so that your brain can reset its baseline equilibrium and continue to be equally responsive without the development of tolerance. But I do want to kind of, you know, point out how different your experience, Joe, with addicted family members. You know, you've seen that happen and how tragic and life destructive that is. But if we contrast it with Michael, who called in earlier, who has actually been able to take opioids at moderate doses on a daily basis and find relief, it really speaks to the tremendous inter-individual differences in response to a medication like an opioid. It really is true that you can have some individuals who don't develop tolerance and who continue to benefit at modest doses, and for whom opioids really might be the best intervention for their particular pain condition. And then you have other individuals, like your family members, who have this probably innate genetic propensity to become addicted. And for those individuals, it's just an absolute disaster to prescribe opioids long-term for pain. So what we need to find is better screening tools to figure out who are the patients that will benefit and who are the patients who are at high risk. One of the kind of simple screening tools is to simply ask patients, do they have a history of addiction to any type of drug? Those people are at greatly increased risk to become addicted to opioids. Do they have a family history, in particular a parent or a grandparent with addiction? Those patients are at increased risk to become addicted to prescription opioids. Those two simple questions, which doctors seldom ask, could make a big difference in kind of differentiating who are the people who are potentially at risk to the adverse effects of long-term opioid use.
All right. We have several calls in. We're going to try to get to as many of them as possible, but we haven't even gotten to solutions yet. Let's go to Christiana. Christiana, welcome to the program. Make your comment brief, please.
Hi, my name is Christiana, and my question is around the use of naloxone. And I have heard that there are some take-home formulations for naloxone, and I just wondered, how do you think that affects, or where do you think that would be placed into your practice when prescribing an opioid?
Thanks very much, Christiana.
So naloxone is a medication, a chemical that blocks the mu opioid receptor, and that's the receptor to which the opioid painkiller binds. So it blocks, or it goes onto that receptor with a lot of affinity, so that if someone on opioids is administered naloxone, it'll essentially bump the opioid out of the receptor and reverse a potential opioid withdrawal. So what's happened now is there's a huge push to make naloxone available to patients who are getting opioid prescriptions, so that their loved ones, if they should happen to accidentally or intentionally overdose on their prescription opioid or heroin, or whatever opioid it is, can reverse that overdose.
Thanks so much, Christiana, for your call. Quick question there. Is the change, a potential change in prescribing, a lot of concern that that'll drive more people towards heroin, people who are addicted and can't access treatment or don't want to access treatment?
Right. So there's concern that with naloxone, what'll happen, well, so this is the concern that was expressed when people first started hearing about naloxone, but it turns out to be not substantiated by the evidence. The concern is that, well, if you give people naloxone, then they'll be more inclined to use more opioids because they know they can just reverse the overdose if they take too much. And although that might be a kind of common sense thought about the effect of naloxone, it turns out it's not true. What we see, in fact, when naloxone is more widely available is that opioid overdoses do, in fact, go down. So it has a very important public health benefit.
What I actually – that's great to point out. What I meant was as people are – our doctors are changing their prescribing habits, is this going to just drive more heroin use over time? That's another concern I've heard.
So heroin use, including heroin overdoses, have quadrupled in the last 4 to 5 years. Driving that increase in heroin use and heroin overdose is young people, so people 18 to 25 years old. There is a prevailing narrative that you'll hear in the media and elsewhere is that the reason that there's been an increase in heroin is because people can't get their opioids from their doctor anymore, so they're turning to heroin. There's a good article in the New England Journal of Medicine that came out early this year that essentially refutes that theory or shows that there's not much evidence to support that it's the people who can't get the opioids from a doctor who are turning to heroin. It's not to say that there's no relationship between the overprescribing and heroin. There is, but the relationship probably goes something more like this. You have a young person who gets a wisdom tooth removal and gets opioids or has a sports injury and gets opioids, and then after one or two experiences of opioids, develops a taste for it and then turns to heroin because it's cheaper and easier than having to go around to a bunch of doctors to try to get it. So I think that's a key point there because I think one of the prevailing narratives is that doctors no longer prescribing opioids as readily has led to this heroin epidemic. And I really think it's the overprescribing that created the taste for opioids among young people in particular that has led to increased heroin use.
So with a minute and a half left to our program, I said before we went out to air, I want to spend time on solutions, but it's important that we unpack this to the degree that we have. So quickly, what are the things that are going to get us out of this mess?
So I really feel that the most important solution, everybody talks about educating doctors more about addiction, about educating them more about non-opioid alternatives for chronic pain. That's absolutely essential from the first day of medical school onward, and not just doctors, nurse practitioners, medical assistants. But I really feel that to really get at the heart of this problem, we have to change the incentives within healthcare so that doctors are no longer incentivized just to prescribe a pill or do a procedure, a kind of a quick fix that makes the patient happy in the short term, but in the long term probably doesn't help them. I can make more in 5 minutes of seeing a patient and writing a prescription, much, much more than I make a whole hour doing psychotherapy with a patient or educating them. We have to change the reimbursement structure so that we actually incentivize and pay doctors to provide the kind of care that will lead to long-term healing. That's one big thing. I also think that it's very important that we reform disability so it doesn't foster invalidism. That's a much larger project. And we really need to ask ourselves as a society, do we really want medicine to be our only social safety net? Right now we have emergency doctors passing out bags of groceries. Those are very expensive bags of groceries. Is that really how we want to do this? If it is, then let's make sure we give doctors the resources and the tools and the funds to provide those sorts of social determinants of health to help really help people in the long run. I also hope that people who identify as having an illness as part of their prime identity adopt more of a recovery narrative that fosters wellness instead of chronic invalidism.
And I want to thank our guest, Dr. Anna Lemke, author of the book Drug Dealer MD, How Doctors Were Duped, Patients Got Hooked, and Why It's So Hard to Stop, for joining me this evening. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Our engineer this evening was David LaTulipe. Tonight's show was produced by Wendy Holcomb. Please join us next week as my co-host Ethan Elkind talks about the potential impacts of the Trump presidency on life and government in the Bay Area. And before we go, again, a call out to you, our listeners. City Visions is celebrating 25 years on the air here in KLW. We're preparing for our December 12th anniversary program, and we'll look back to the defining moments in the Bay Area history and culture over the last 25 years, and we want to hear from you. Which local events, people, and ideas have most influenced you and our region? Let us know. Email us at cityvisions@kalw.org. This is Joseph Pache. Thanks for listening. Good night and have a great week.